This morning from the Old Testament book of 2 Samuel. We're going to read three sections. So first of all in chapter 17, 2 Samuel 17. You might wonder what's going on here as we launch into this narrative, but the context is Absalom's rebellion against his father David, and the Ahithophel that we shall encounter straight away in this chapter, he is Absalom's counselor, Absalom's advisor. So let's read from the opening verse of 2 Samuel 17. Moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, "Let me choose 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue David tonight. I will come upon him while he is weary and discouraged, and throw him into a panic, and all the people who are with him will flee. I will strike down only the king, and I will bring all the people back to you as a bride comes home to her husband. You seek the life of only one man, and all the people will be at peace." And the advice seemed right in the eyes of Absalom and all the elders of Israel. Then Absalom said, "Call Hushai the Archite also, and let us hear what he has to say." And when Hushai came to Absalom, Absalom said to him, "Thus has Ahithophel spoken, shall we do as he says? If not, you speak." Then Hushai said to Absalom, "This time the counsel that Ahithophel has given is not good." Hushai said, "You know that your father and his men are mighty men, and that they are enraged like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. Besides, your father is experienced in war. He will not spend the night with the people. Behold, even now he has hidden himself in one of the pits or in some other place. And as soon as some of the people fall at the first attack, whoever hears it will say, 'There has been a slaughter among the people who follow Absalom.' Then even the valiant man, whose heart is like the heart of a lion, will utterly melt with fear, for all Israel knows that your father is a mighty man, and that those who are with him are valiant men. But my counsel is that all Israel be gathered to you from Dan to Beersheba, as the sand by the sea for multitude, and that you go to battle in person. So we shall come upon him in some place where he is to be found, and we shall light upon him as the dew falls on the ground, and of him and all the men with him not one will be left. If he withdraws into a city, then all Israel will bring ropes to that city, and we shall drag it into the valley until not even a pebble is to be found there." And Absalom and all the men of Israel said, "The counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel." For the Lord had ordained to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel, so that the Lord might bring harm upon Absalom. And then we're just going to jump forward to verse 23 of the same chapter. When Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his donkey and went off home to his own city. He set his house in order and hanged himself, and he died and was buried in the tomb of his father. Then David came to Mahanaim, and Absalom crossed the Jordan with all the men of Israel. Now Absalom had set Amasa over the army instead of Joab. Amasa was the son of a man named Ithrah the Ishmaelite, who had married Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, sister of Zeruiah, Joab's mother. And Israel and Absalom encamped in the land of Gilead. When David came to Mahanaim, Shobi the son of Nahash from Rabbah of the Ammonites, and Machir the son of Amiel from Lo-Debar, and Barzillai the Gileadite from Rogalim, brought beds, basins, and earthen vessels, wheat, barley, flour, parched grain, beans and lentils, honey and curds, and sheep and cheese from the herd, for David and the people with him to eat, for they said, "The people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness." And then just one more short section in chapter 19, reading from verse 31. And by this stage now, Absalom's rebellion is over, and Absalom is dead, and David is returning to Jerusalem. And we read chapter 19, verse 31. Now Barzillai the Gileadite had come down from Rogalim, and he went on with the king to the Jordan to escort him over the Jordan. Barzillai was a very aged man, 80 years old. He had provided the king with food while he stayed at Mahanaim, for he was a very wealthy man. And the king said to Barzillai, "Come over with me, and I will provide for you with me in Jerusalem." But Barzillai said to the king, "How many years have I still to live that I should go up with the king to Jerusalem? I am this day 80 years old. Can I discern what is pleasant and what is not? Can your servant taste what he eats or what he drinks? Can I still listen to the voice of singing men and singing women? Why then should your servant be an added burden to my lord the king? Your servant will go a little way over the Jordan with the king. Why should the king repay me with such a reward? Please let your servant return, that I may die in my own city near the grave of my father and my mother. But here is your servant Chimham. Let him go over with my lord the king, and do for him whatever seems good to you. And the king answered, "Chimham shall go over with me, and I will do for him whatever seems good to you, and all that you desire of me I will do for you." Then all the people went over the Jordan, and the king went over, and the king kissed Barzillai and blessed him, and he returned to his own home. Amen. Now, many of you, I'm sure, are fairly familiar with the life of David, and familiar, therefore, with many individuals whose lives in some way intersected with the life of David. People like Saul and Jonathan and Samuel and Goliath and Joab and Abigail, and so we could go on. But one individual with whom you might not be quite so familiar is the man of whom we've read in a couple of places just there this morning, Barzillai. But Barzillai is another person whose life intersected with David's life. And so this morning I would like us to consider this man, Barzillai, for a few minutes. He may be a minor contributor to the overall Old Testament story, but I think we can benefit from spending some time paying attention to this man. And so there are two particular things that I want us to notice in connection with Barzillai. And first of all, he's a welcome man. That's our first heading. He's a welcome man. So Barzillai's brief appearance in the David story, it occurs at a very bleak point within that story. Things are hugely depressing for David. Absalom is wreaking havoc. Now, for David to have to endure any large-scale rebellion, any attempted coup, is bad enough. But the fact that this one is coming from within his family, the fact it's his own son who is trying to wrest the throne from him, that makes it absolutely devastating. And this is no lame, unrealistic bid for Israel's throne by Absalom either. This is serious stuff, so much so that David is forced to flee the palace, he's forced to flee the city. David is forced into exile. So that's the depressing setting here. How does Barzillai fit into it? Well, as David and his companions are fleeing, Barzillai suddenly turns up there at the end of chapter 17. We read it. He suddenly turns up with a whole load of provisions, basic necessities in the realms of sleeping and washing and eating in order to keep David and his men going. And so you can see then, can't you, how against this dark backdrop, Barzillai's appearance is a bit of relief for David. I think you sense it in that unnecessarily long list of items that we have there at the end of chapter 17. I mean, the narrator could just have summarized the items, couldn't he? He could have just said, well, Barzillai brought a whole load of stuff for David. But instead, he kind of lists all the things that Barzillai brought. And I think the narrator's almost giving the reader an insight into David's own relish at receiving this gift. I mean, you know what it's like yourself, perhaps, if you're going through a period where you're feeling got at by people and you're feeling unloved. And then one morning you wake up and there's a John Lewis hamper that someone has left on your doorstep. Well, you might well get on the phone to a friend and talk your friend through every item that's in that hamper. You know, there's hot chocolate in there, and there are ginger cookies in there, and there's fruitcake, and there's cheese. And your friend doesn't need to know all the stuff that's in the hamper. But it's as if kind of vocalizing each item one by one drives it home a bit deeper to you. Yes, somebody does love me. Somebody is thinking about me. Somebody does care for me. And I'm saying then that the narrator here perhaps captures David's own perspective as he lists all these items that Barzillai brought to him. So in a very obvious way then, Barzillai is a welcome man for David at this point in David's story. But in that connection, I just want to probe this a little more deeply and uncover three encouraging principles here. Principle number one then, the wonder of God's grace. The wonder of God's grace. Now, it's always very important whenever we're considering this whole period of David's life to remember that the Absalom rebellion is not some mysterious, random phenomenon that suddenly blows up in David's life. No, it is the fulfillment of prophecy. It's the fulfillment of the prophecy which Nathan spoke to David back in chapter 12 of this same book, in the aftermath of David's adultery with Bathsheba and David's arrangement of the death of Bathsheba's husband, Uriah. And you remember how Nathan comes to see David and how he confronts David. And this is what he says to David in 2 Samuel 12, verses 7 to 10. Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you out of the hand of Saul. And I gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your arms, and gave you the house of Israel and of Judah. And if this were too little, I would add to you as much more. Why have you despised the word of the Lord to do what is evil in his sight? You have struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword and have taken his wife to be your wife and have killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now therefore, Nathan says, now therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. So the sword shall never depart from your house. Nathan there is prophesying bloodshed and violence within David's family. And yes, at one level, I think he's talking about a pattern of violence that is going to unfold over a period of time. But at the same time, the prophecy also points particularly to one outstanding eruption of violence, namely Absalom. And we know that because Nathan continues in verse 11 of chapter 12. I will raise up evil against you out of your own house, and I will take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of this son. And that's exactly what Absalom did to David. And so I'm saying then that the Absalom rebellion, it's not random, it's the consequence of David's sin. It's the fulfillment of Nathan's prophecy in the aftermath of David's sin. In fact, David himself seems to recognize that all of this is happening as the result of his sin with Bathsheba. There's an interesting little moment in chapter 16 and verse 11. It's where David is departing from Jerusalem. And as he's departing from Jerusalem, this man, Shimei, comes and starts cursing David. And you remember how as Shimei is throwing these curses at David, David's men, they say to David, let us go and sort out this guy Shimei. Let us go and put him to death. And David won't let them. And this is what David says in verse 11 of chapter 16. Behold, my own son seeks my life. How much more now may this Benjaminite, that's Shimei, leave him alone and let him curse. For the Lord has told him to. The Lord has told him to. I don't think David just means that in a general kind of providential sense that ultimately everything can be traced back to the Lord, which is true. But I think he means specifically, Shimei is doing this to me. And Absalom is doing this to me. And all of this is happening to me. Because the Lord is chastising me because I have sinned so grievously against him. So here in this whole Absalom episode then, God is sternly dealing with his badly erring servant David. And yet, the remarkable thing is that even as God is being so stern, his grace comes through. Even as he's in the process of disciplining David, he sends Barzillai along with a whole load of provisions for David. With one hand, God is chastising David. With the other hand, he's pouring out blessings on David. It's almost as though his grace is so instinctive, so irrepressible, he just can't help himself. God just can't bring himself to be all sternness and nothing else toward one of his own children. What a God we have this morning. God is certainly not the spineless, effeminate, all-endorsing Father Christmas-like God of so much contemporary Christianity. He does take David's sin seriously, but nor toward his own blood-bought children is he the harsh, grudge-bearing, always accusing God that our troubled consciences sometimes imagine him to be. No, in the midst of his fatherly anger, he does not stop being kind to David. How breathtaking is the grace of God. How mysterious, how incomparable, how uninventable this grace of God, that even as he's chastising David for what David has done with Bathsheba and with Uriah, God still is kindly sending Barzillai to look after David and to provide for David's needs. And so that's one encouraging principle, the wonder of God's grace. Another principle, the packaging of God's blessings. The packaging of God's blessings. Because we're focusing on Barzillai this morning, but actually it's not just Barzillai, is it, that brings whole load of provisions for David. Three men approach David there at the end of chapter 17. And as David saw these three men coming toward him, and as they got close enough for him to properly take them in, I very much doubt that his heart leapt at the prospect of this encounter. I mean, they're a motley crew, these three men. So the first man that's mentioned there in verse 27 of chapter 17, it's Shobi. Now, David may not have known Shobi, but he probably immediately recognized from his appearance that he was a foreigner. He was not an Israelite. He was an Ammonite. The second man is Machir. Now, David would have known Machir, and he would have recognized Machir. And he would have known Machir to be heavily associated with Saul's family. Back in chapter 9, verses 4 and 5, Machir was the one who was looking after Saul's grandson, Mephibosheth. You remember how David was wanting to show kindness to Mephibosheth. And so David is directed to this man, Machir, because he's the guardian of Mephibosheth. And then there's Barzillai. And David may not have known him before, but he would have immediately been struck probably by his elderliness and by all the frailty associated with that. Notice for a moment the location where this encounter takes place. It takes place at Mahanaim. What does Mahanaim mean? Well, the Hebrew word means literally two camps. And Mahanaim was given that name, you may remember, by Jacob. In Genesis chapter 32, Jacob is on his way back from exile. He's been in exile for 20 years with his uncle Laban. He had to flee, you remember, from Esau. Esau wanted to kill him, and so Jacob has gone off, and he's lived with Laban for 20 years, and now Jacob is finally returning home. And it's a troubled situation for Jacob. He doesn't know how he's going to find Esau. Is Esau still going to be mad with him, still wanting to kill him? Or is Esau now going to be pacified? He doesn't know. It's a worrying, uneasy, unsettling time for Jacob. And in those circumstances, God encourages Jacob by sending to him a troop of angels. And the angels come and meet Jacob at the beginning of Genesis 32. And so Jacob calls the place Mahanaim, two camps. In other words, he's saying, there's my camp here. There's me and my wives and my concubines and my children and my animals. There's my camp. But there's also this other camp, this heavenly camp, this celestial camp of angels that God has graciously sent to protect me and to accompany me and to look after me. And so he called the place Mahanaim. And here's David now. And David is in the same place. And he's in similarly troubled circumstances. For him, it's not his brother that's the problem. It's his son, Absalom, that's the problem. And yet David sees no troop of angels coming toward him. Just three men. One, a non-Israelite, and so probably hostile. One connected with Saul, and so he probably has issues. And one who's very old, and so he probably has little to offer. But then they open their mouths, and they say, David, we've got all these provisions that we want to give to you. A smile must have started to break out on David's face. Wow, Mahanaim was living up to its name and to its history. After all, God was blessing him there, just as all those centuries earlier he'd blessed Jacob there. But in his case, the blessing came in a very surprising packaging. Not a troop of angels, but just these three motley men. And isn't that how God often blesses us? In a kind of hidden, disguised way, the blessing comes often in a surprising packaging. I sometimes think of the day in the land of Moab when Mahlon first brought his new girlfriend Ruth home and introduced her to his mother Naomi. I wonder what Naomi's first impression was. Perhaps immediately she thought, oh, Ruth looks like a nice girl. Or perhaps that kind of maternal protective instinct kicked in. Perhaps instinctively she was suspicious and rightfully had misgivings because she was a Moabitess and she wasn't an Israelite. And her son shouldn't really be courting this girl at all. Whatever Naomi thought in that moment, Naomi could not for one moment have envisaged, could she, that that girl standing in front of her, Ruth, that girl would become the greatest blessing in her whole life. She would become a girl who would provide for her, Naomi, in her widowhood. In fact, through that girl, Ruth, Naomi would come to nurse a child in her old age, a child who would be an ancestor of the Messiah himself. Naomi just could not have dreamt in that first encounter with Ruth the blessings that God was pouring out on her through that unlikely Moabitess. I mean, if we grasp this, if we grasp that God so often blesses us and the blessing comes in a surprising packaging, we would approach our different situations tomorrow morning with so much more relish, wouldn't we? Not, oh no, another day in this soul-destroying office of mine. Not, oh no, an 8-hour flight seated next to this strange-looking guy I've been put next to. But rather, how might God be blessing me today in this set of circumstances, however unpromising its appearance may be? Such a different outlook to life if we could only grasp this principle. The packaging of God's blessings. And then a third principle, the quietness of God's victory. The quietness of God's victory. I read most of chapter 17 to you earlier on, and I think that this chapter is intended to convey to us a paradox. You see, on the surface, God's enemies are triumphing here in 2 Samuel 17. Absalom has Jerusalem. The king is fleeing Jerusalem. I mean, that's the big story. That's the news story on every Israelite news channel every evening. Absalom's taken Jerusalem. David's in exile. On the surface, God's enemies are triumphing. But when you probe beneath the surface, a different story starts to emerge. Absalom's only hope of success, the brilliant counselor Ahithophel, whom he had lured actually from David, he has quietly gone to his hometown and taken his own life. Hushai, who is loyal to David, is quietly feeding Absalom bad advice in order to ruin him. And now at the end of the chapter, David's needs are being quietly met by Barzillai and his two companions. And it's all very low key and it's all very much beneath the radar. And yet in chapter 17, I'm saying if you look beneath the bluster, God's cause is quietly flourishing. And again, isn't it so often like that today? I mean, we hear so much on the news, don't we, about the mass migration of people into Europe and the refugee camps and all this kind of thing, and we hear a lot about that. We don't hear what God is doing in and through all of that, and the way in which God is bringing people from the most closed countries in the world to our continent in order that they might hear the gospel and be saved. So there's one friend of mine who visits refugee camps in Europe regularly, wrote to me recently, "Today, across Europe and the Western Hemisphere, thousands of Muslims are turning to Christ. Many of them asylum seekers. This turning of Muslims to the Lord is unprecedented in 14 centuries of Islam." We don't hear about that side of it, do we? Just beneath the radar, God at work, God quietly victorious. Or we can bring it closer to home, and we hear so much in the news about how Christianity is waning in our own land and the statistics of church going on a Sunday and all the rest of it. We hear all of that. But what about your growth in holiness over the last few months? What about your progress in becoming a better husband or a better wife? A more faithful citizen, a more obedient child, a more diligent employee. I mean, that in its own way is as miraculous as the creation of the universe, and yet that doesn't get reported on the 10 o'clock news, does it? Fiona Bruce will never be heard talking about your sanctification over the last 12 months. But again, God at work, quietly, beneath the radar, below the surface. And so I'm saying then that in the first place this morning, Barzillai, he's a welcome man. So welcome to David at this point, this low point in his career. And kind of wrapped up in all of that, we see these three encouraging principles. The wonder of God's grace, gracious even when chastising. The packaging of God's blessings, they so often come in the most unlikely form. And the quietness of God's victory, he's fulfilling his purposes, often beneath the radar. Barzillai's a welcome man. But then secondly, this morning, he's a wedded man. He's a wedded man. And I don't mean by that he was married, literally, although he presumably was married, literally, because we read in the Old Testament of Barzillai's children. But what I mean is he was wedded to David. Barzillai was wedded to David. I mean, at this point in Israel's history, most of the nation had been swept off its feet by Absalom. Absalom was young. Absalom was handsome. Absalom was slick. Absalom was impressive. Most of the land had been swept off its feet by him. Barzillai hadn't. David is the divinely chosen king. Absalom is not. And as far as Barzillai is concerned, that settles the matter. That's all that matters. David is God's man. And so Barzillai is wedded to David. And there's an obvious line of application then that you can perhaps already begin to see before I even mention it. David anticipates the greater divinely chosen king, Jesus. And so we are to be Barzillai's in relation to him. What Barzillai was to King David, loyal, wedded, faithful, we are to be to the greater King Jesus, loyal, wedded, faithful. I'm not sure that loyalty is a particularly glamorous concept in our society today. I'm not even sure it's always a particularly glamorous concept within the Christian church today. You know, I'm always struck by that scene in Luke 22. It's the last hours before Jesus' passion. And he has that supper with his disciples in the upper room. And it's so striking, so depressing, isn't it? And yet so real, that in Luke 22, verse 24, we read that a dispute arose among them as to which of them was to be regarded as the greatest. This is the Last Supper. This is in that upper room. Their Lord about to go to the cross, and the disciples, they're arguing about which one of them is the greatest. There's Peter, and he's saying, look, guys, I think I'm at the top of the pecking order here. I think I'm the top disciple. After all, have any of you guys ever walked on water? Don't think so, but I have. At which point Andrew steps in. Ah, but hang on a minute, Peter. Who was it that found out first Jesus was the Messiah? It wasn't you. It was me. I told you about Jesus. You didn't tell me. At which point John enters the fray. Ah, but guys, who is it that sits next to Jesus and puts his head in Jesus' bosom? I'm doing it this very moment. I think I'm a bit greater than you lot. And so it was going on, and they were all then advancing their competing claims to greatness amongst the apostolic group. And Jesus has to deal with that then, and he deals with it in verses 25 and to 27, and he talks about how the Gentiles are like this, and they kind of seek kudos and seek reputation. You shouldn't be like that, and all the rest of it. But then he says something interesting in verse 28. He says this: you are those who have stayed with me in my trials. And you think, well, Jesus, what's that going to do with it? It just seems like a non sequitur. Why is Jesus saying that here when he's dealing with their pride and their competition about who's the greatest? Why does he say, you are those who have stayed with me in my trials? Well, I think his point is this. This, he's saying, is true greatness. In my eyes and in my Heavenly Father's eyes, true greatness is not walking on water. And it's not finding out first that I was the Messiah. And it's not even having your head in my bosom at the table. True greatness in my eyes and in my Father's eyes is sheer, stubborn loyalty to me. I mean, think about it. Here's Jesus, and throughout that week, he's been teaching in the temple, and there've been crowds listening to him. Where are the crowds now? The crowds have all disappeared. And here they are, and in fact, even one of the 12 has now disappeared. There's only 11 of them. And Jesus is becoming more and more unpopular and more of a lonely figure as he hurtles toward the cross. And Jesus is saying, true greatness is sticking with me even when everyone else deserts me. Even when everyone else hates me, even when everyone else bangs nails through my flesh and attaches me to a cross, true greatness in my eyes and in my Father's eyes is sticking by me. It's loyalty to your King, even when your King is deeply, deeply unpopular. And is it not the case that we, in our contemporary Christian circles, can so often be where those disciples were in that upper room? And we have a kind of celebrity culture, and we put the great preachers and the great authors on a pedestal and all the rest of it. And we forget that what the Lord values more than anything is loyalty. Sticking with him, even in a society that increasingly hates Jesus. And I'm saying then that Barzillai is a wonderful Old Testament model of this loyalty that ought to be the characteristic of the Christian disciple. And just in that connection then, as we close, three things about Barzillai's loyalty. First of all, it's disinterested loyalty. It's disinterested loyalty. Now, we tend to confuse two words, don't we? Disinterested and uninterested. Uninterested means that you're bored with something, you're apathetic about it. Disinterested doesn't mean that. Disinterested means that you do something. If you do something in a disinterested way, you do it even though you don't stand to gain from it. You do it for its own sake, not because you're going to gain something from it. And that's what we see with Barzillai and his loyalty to King David. You see, it's not that Barzillai is a clever chap. And he foresees that this Absalom thing, it'll blow over. Absalom won't win. He'll be defeated eventually. And David will come back, and David will be restored, and David will be reinstated. And so Barzillai thinks to himself, hang on a minute. If I'm loyal to David through this troubled period, then once David's reinstated, David will be very pleased with me, and he'll reward me, and he'll promote me, and I'll receive all kinds of good things from David. That was not Barzillai's motive. We know that, don't we? Because, of course, the Absalom rebellion does blow over, and David is reinstated, and David does want to reward Barzillai. He wants Barzillai to come and live with him in the palace and eat at his table. And what does Barzillai say? No, thanks. Not interested. I'd rather go back home, thank you. Barzillai was not being loyal to David because of what was in it for him. It was disinterested loyalty. I think that's a probing question to ask ourselves this morning in relation to our loyalty to King Jesus. I think it's a good thing sometimes to step right back and ask ourselves, at the end of the day, when I strip everything else away, what is the real reason I'm a Christian? Why am I a Christian? Why do I keep on living as a Christian? Why do I keep on serving Jesus Christ? What's the ultimate reason for that? We talk, don't we, about the Garden of Eden and that great verse there, Genesis 3:15. We talk about that as the proto-euangelion, the first promise of the gospel, the first kind of gospel promise spoken there in the Garden of Eden. Actually, when you read it, it's not a promise at all. It's a threat. It's not God speaking to Adam and Eve, is it? And saying, Adam and Eve, this disaster's just happened, but it's okay. I'm going to send a savior who will die for you and who will wash you clean with his blood and make you right with God again. That's not what God says. It's God not speaking to Adam and Eve. It's God speaking to the serpent and saying, I'm going to send a savior who will smash your skull to pieces. It's a threat, not a promise. But you see, I suppose we like to put ourselves at the center of the whole story, don't we? And we like to say then that Jesus is our king who defeats our enemy and secures our everlasting glory. Whereas actually, in the first place, Jesus is God's king who defeats God's enemy and restores God's glory. And I'm saying then that Barzillai, he seems to understand that framework, and he's not loyal to David because of what's in it for him. He's loyal to David because David, in a provisional Old Testament sense, is God's king who destroys God's enemies and restores God's glory. And I wonder then, is that why you are loyal to Jesus at the end of the day? Perhaps you could put it this way, when you look forward to Jesus' return, and we should be looking forward to Jesus' return, shouldn't we? Why is it that you're looking forward to Jesus' return? What is it precisely you're looking forward to? Is it that you're looking forward to all the rewards, the resurrection of the body, the inheritance of the new world, and so on? Now, we certainly should be looking forward to those things, and the Bible holds them before us as tantalizing prospects to look forward to indeed. But should we not also, indeed, should we not primarily be looking forward to the sheer fact that on that day Jesus Christ will have won? And Jesus Christ will receive the recognition that is rightfully his. And on that day every knee will bow to him and every tongue will confess that he is Lord. And on that day he will be vindicated and no one will be mocking him anymore and no one will be resisting him anymore. But on that day, Jesus will be center stage exactly where Jesus deserves to be. Is that not what we should be looking forward to? If we've got the Barzillai spirit about us? a disinterested loyalty, a loyalty that's not primarily about what's in it for us, but a loyalty that primarily seeks the glory and the honor and the recognition and the vindication of our King Jesus. It's disinterested loyalty. Secondly, it's elderly loyalty. It's elderly loyalty. I mean, Barzillai describes his elderliness with stark realism, doesn't he, there in chapter 19 as he's addressing David. By the way, it's a reminder to us of the foolishness of living for wealth and stuff. I mean, Barzillai is wealthy, we're told that. But he can't enjoy now the benefits of his wealth. He can get the finest food and drink, he says, but he can't taste it anymore. He can get the finest entertainers, but he can't hear them anymore. And it's a reminder, isn't it, of the foolishness of living for something that is so transient, so ephemeral, so brief, so fleeting. That old age will probably take from us, and death certainly will take from us. Only live for that which nothing can take from you. Only live for that which old age cannot take from you, and that even death can't take from you. And there's only one thing that fits that category, and that's Jesus. Only if you can say, "For me to live is Christ," can you then also say, "For me to die is gain." If the motto of your life is, "For me to live is money," then death is going to part you from your money. If the motto of your life is, "For me to live is popularity," death's going to part you from your popularity. "For me to live is success," death's going to part you from your success. Death will part you from everything that you're living for unless you're living for Christ. And that's the only thing that you can live for that death cannot part you from. But back to Barzillai, and he's not living, of course, for his wealth, but it's just a reminder to us of how ephemeral, how transient wealth is. But the real point I want to make here is this, that Barzillai may have displayed great loyalty to David in earlier points of his life, but the only expression of loyalty to David that the scriptures record for us in Barzillai is this expression when he's an old man. And you might think, well, you know, what can Barzillai do for David? He can't go out there on the battlefield and fight Absalom. He can't chase Absalom through the forests and thrust spears through him like Joab would. What can Absalom do in this situation? He's useless. No, he's not useless. There's something he can do. He can at least muster some provisions and take them out to David and encourage David massively at a point when David is feeling low. And we're never too elderly, we're never too infirm, we're never too weak to usefully serve our King Jesus. Perhaps you need to hear that this morning. Perhaps it's a great temptation to you to think that you're over the hill now, you're past it now. Your years of Christian usefulness are over now. They're never over, as long as you have breath. You can be useful to King Jesus. And Barzillai then is a precious reminder of that to us. It's disinterested loyalty. It's elderly loyalty. And then finally, it's remembered loyalty. It's remembered loyalty. I mean, you might think, okay, this gesture by Barzillai here at the end of chapter 17, it means a lot to David at the time because David is in such a low place at the time. But in the grand scheme of things, it's not a big deal, is it, taking out a pile of provisions to him? It'll soon be forgotten. Once David is back on the throne again, once David has bigger fish to fry and he's fighting against the Philistines and he's running half of the known world of the day, he won't remember what Barzillai did that night. Actually, David does remember. We know David remembers. Because when you go to 1 Kings chapter 2, David is now an old man. Barzillai must be long dead by now. And Solomon is about to take David's place on the throne. And David gives Solomon some instructions. There are some loose ends from David's reign that he wants Solomon to tie up, to see to once David's dead. And one of them is this, 1 Kings 2, verse 7. Deal loyally with the sons of Barzillai the Gileadite, and let them be among those who eat at your table. For with such loyalty they met me when I fled from Absalom, your brother. All those decades later, all that success later, and David still remembers what Barzillai did for him on that day. And King Jesus remembers. Think of those extraordinary words he speaks in Mark 9:41. Truly I say to you, whoever gives you a cup of water to drink because you belong to Christ will by no means lose his reward. What's a cup of water? It's nothing. It's something to Jesus. He values it when it's done for him. Those little things that you do, the little phone calls to a discouraged brother or sister, the little note you write to someone, you go and get the groceries for a brother or sister in Christ who is too infirm to go shopping themselves. And these are just little things. And nobody else notices them, and you don't do them to be noticed by anyone, but Jesus notices them, and Jesus values them, and they bring a smile to the face of our heavenly Master, Jesus Christ. And let me just close then by saying this. That if King David was worth being this loyal to, how much more worth being loyal to is King Jesus? David was a flawed king. We've seen that already this morning. He could commit adultery. He could commit murder. David was a flawed king. And if he was worth Barzillai showing such loyalty towards, what about our perfect king? Our king who never commits adultery, never murders. Our glorious, sublime, beautiful king. How worthy of our loyalty is he? Perhaps some of you don't have him as your king this morning. Let me commend him to you. There's no better master, there's no better king than Jesus. Why would you not want the beautiful, crucified Jesus Christ as your king? Bow before him. Say in the words of the hymn, King of my life, I crown thee now. And if you are Jesus' subject this morning, if you are under his kingship, then be a Barzillai. And throughout the remainder of your days, be loyal, loyal, loyal. In a society that is on a trajectory of ever increasing hatred of Jesus, be loyal, stick with him. And then you will be with your King for all eternity. May it indeed be so. Amen.